Welcome back to TRP.
Hi, welcome back to the Rosslare podcast. Today, I am delighted to say we have an excerpt from the MEPs Mick Wallace and Claire Daly's discussions on episode 40 of their I Foresee Trouble podcast. And that is the letter I, the number 4, the letter C, and Trouble, T-R-O-U-B-L-E with a capital T. So I hope you sit back and enjoy this interesting conversation.
And then back to COVID, Mick. And you did say you want to talk about it now.
Listen,
I'm sick talking about it. I actually don't. But anyway, you.
The world and his aunt are sick talking about COVID, except we should probably add, in fairness, I don't think the media have got tired of it yet.
Mm.
In fact, it's an absolute godsend because they don't have to do anything else than only talking about COVID. And it's funny, but I don't think that the couple of times I was home in the last year, I thought it was saturation coverage on COVID, and it hasn't gone away. It's still going on, especially now that Brexit is not there as a competitor, which was saturated for over 3 years. The odd time I've been in Italy, I don't see quite as much coverage of COVID morning, noon and night. And I don't see it in Belgium either. It's a big issue everywhere. And of course, it's the thing that's dominating people's lives, especially if you're in lockdown. But now all the talk anyway is people have kind of moved on from, in one sense, from moving, trying to deal with COVID now to the vaccine rollout is the biggest game in town. But the COVID issues haven't gone away, and people more know that too well because they're still in lockdowns. And how do you come out of the lockdown? Do you come out sooner or later? How should you know when is the right time to come out? I was listening to a podcast yesterday morning, Novara Media, which I find very good. They're English. They're based in London. And the English did a survey about should restrictions be lifted more now on the 1st of April or should they stay the same? And there was a fairly widespread poll done, and the country was split right down the middle on it. It was 49%, 51% on the issue.
And that's interesting. I mean, and particularly when you consider that actually their vaccination rollout has been far in excess of anything that in any EU country, for example. So, you know, they're still split, even though a lot more of their people are getting vaccinated. And actually, there's a huge confidence in their vaccination programme and the speed at which it's progressing, which is interesting as well. It kind of augurs for the future. It's not going to be just as simple as vaccine and go or jab and go, as Michael O'Leary tells us, you know. I don't think we'd be seeing that.
Yeah, look, I think the discussion is slowly moving around to the point of when everyone is vaccinated, are we all going to be safe then from COVID? Or are we still going to have some restrictions? How will the EU deal with it? How will each member state deal with it? Will there be uniformity around the decision-making across Europe? Or will it still be ad hoc? Will it be a bit of this here and a bit of that there? There's also a lot of discussion around the fact that the European Union did it centralised the purchase of the vaccine and is obviously also involved in the rollout, but so is the member state. And people are asking, are the EU now going to get more directly involved with a central health policy for Europe? Because we were always told that health was a competency of each member state, and it wasn't the European Union's place to be going there, even though we would argue that the EU, along with ECB and the IMF, put huge pressure on Ireland to make cutbacks in the area of health, and we're paying a bit of a price for that at the moment, given that our hospitals are afraid of their lives of COVID getting out of hand, and the strain been too much, and that is a possibility when you have a system that's not totally fit for purpose, which ours isn't. And that probably is also linked to the fear from the Irish politicians in how they've dealt with the lockdown.
I think there's two things on that. I mean, I think you're right that the push for the EU to muscle in more in the health area is definitely going to gather force now, which is a little bit ironic given the absolute hames that they made of it, or how slow they were to turn to the situation. Now, I know it was unprecedented and difficult, but still, they did make mistakes too. And actually, the biggest, when we made the point before, the biggest gap that was exposed was the fact that medicine production is in the hands of the private sector, and they haven't learned that a lesson at all. In actual fact, the move is going to try and bolster the private sector. If they'd learned anything, it would be that in order to make everybody safe, then this vaccine has to be made available to everybody in the world, and they would be championing the call to lift the intellectual property restrictions on these vaccines to allow them to be generically produced all over the world so that everybody could be quickly vaccinated. Instead, we have production modified and restrained because of intellectual property rights, meaning that the world's return to health is going to be slowed down, and they're not going to learn that lesson, sadly.
Yeah, the EU is very eager to have more power, and they want more power centralised under their remit. And they saw the vaccine as a huge opportunity to get in on the act, and that they would control the purchase of it and the rollout. And while you're saying, well, they've made a bit of a hames of it, I would argue that in 6 months' time, it's actually going to look okay.
Mm.
I do think the rollout will improve dramatically in April. I think, but your point is completely borne out by the fact that the reason that the rollout is bad now is because we don't have the vaccine. The production, we're waiting on it to be produced. It wasn't in our hands. Big Pharma had us by the short and curlies. We were at their mercy. And I think that is a place we should never allow ourselves to be again. And it will be very unfortunate if they don't learn that lesson and don't start thinking about the fact that the state is paying the hospital bills across Europe. The state is paying for the COVID bailout at the moment. Now, obviously, the citizens are the ones who pay for the state, and we could have an austerity 3 or 4 years down the line to claw back some of this money. But we have the state picking up the tab for all the things that there isn't big money in. And we have the private sector lapping it up where it suits. And production of medicine is one of them. And it's absolutely imperative that we never, ever again allow ourselves to be caught at the mercy of organisations like Big Pharma, who have only one concern, and that's profit. And health is too important for the citizens of Ireland and of Europe to be caught there again. And what we haven't even seen yet, and any of the contracts we've seen between the European Parliament and Big Pharma, everything to do with price has been redacted.
Mm.
Everything, there's no transparency, no accountability. And the price is going to become a bigger factor later on, because when the bill comes in and the European Union and the member states go looking to get the money back, and then we know about the price a bit better.
Well, I think that's a really important point, because, and when the information comes out and it's beginning to trickle out about how much the private shareholders of these companies are raking it in, basically profiting from people's appalling health concerns, that's just sickening for so many people. And I mean, you know, there's huge problems, obviously, in China and Russia and these countries, but they have the legacies of the old system where the state was able to turn everything into the production of vaccines. And we see what Cuba have done as well, providing that vaccine to other countries by the state taking a lead in it. That lesson, we have to keep keeping it out. But I think the other point you touched on, and you're right, and we saw a lot of talk of it around Italy with the appointment of the new president, Mario Draghi, God help us, not a friend of Ireland from his days of Mr. Defend the Euro at any cost, regardless of the austerity, Mr. Austerity himself, but being labelled in Italy as Super Mario. And of course, Italy and Spain between them have got 40% of the funds, the recovery funds, that the EU is dishing out in a combination of grants and loans. But as you're saying, what price is going to be demanded of these? Because there's no such thing as a free ride. And my God almighty, people are going to end up paying again.
And if anyone wants to get a glimpse of the money that's really involved here and the profits involved, have a look at the share price change of the big pharma entities that are producing the vaccine. BioNTech, the German crowd who linked up with Pfizer, their shares in 12 months have increased not 9%, not 19%, 190%. 190%. And Moderna, who wasn't considered one of the bigger players before the start of this crisis, Moderna's share price has gone up over 800%. God help us.
It's an obscenity, like. It is unbelievable.
You're talking billions, and it's the citizens of Europe will be paying it.
Yeah, and like, where is the journalism, like, calling that out? Like, it never gets raised. Like, the dialogue in Ireland, and probably in a lot of Europe, is very much going, when are we in Ireland going to get the vaccine? Or when is the EU getting the vaccine? Not is, how is humanity going to deal with these problems, which is in all of our interests? And they don't even go there, even though an overwhelming majority of the world's countries want the intellectual property rights lifted on this. The clause in the international trade organizations allow a pandemic to trigger that button, such as the exceptional nature of it and the seriousness. But America and the EU and Australia and all of those Atlantis countries are blocking it versus everybody else. And of course, everybody else is the bulk of humanity. It's just disgusting.
Yeah, but it's already linked, and we've talked about it several times on the show, but there's 4.6 billion people living on less than $5 a day. They're hungry, and we are part of the cause of it. And the same as we're part of the reason now that they're not getting their COVID. And remember, the COVID production and the late rollout, later than promised, production supply later than promised, will it cost the pharma industry a penny? Not a penny. Mm. There is no clauses in the contracts that fines them or penalises them in any way for late delivery.
Yeah.
And we're all going mad because we can't get it quick enough, and rightly so. 700,000 people died in Europe in 2020. If the rollout ends up being 3 months later than originally promised, we are looking at a possible extra 150,000 people losing their lives, because we were dependent on big pharma for the supply.
No, that's the lesson. But as you say, the pick-up rate of the vaccination programme will begin to pick up, and hopefully so. But yeah, this discussion continues. One of the things I thought was a positive, ironically, of what COVID did to us was the misuse of Shannon Airport by the US military transiting through, as they do all the time, and as we have raised, as they continue to do during COVID, has actually now woken up the Irish media to the fact that the US military are using Shannon because of COVID breaches. So fair play to Ed Horgan and Shannon Watch and the team there for bringing that out in the news. But it's incredible that it's front page news. It's been on the 6 o'clock news, on the 9 o'clock news, because on at least three occasions, the US military breached COVID conditions coming through, and the embassy is sorry. And the department is sorry, but it's not going to go away.
We even had the department defend them. They were saying, oh, they were living in a very safe bubble. A safe bubble? Mm. There's no one safe from COVID. Mm. And I mean, the notion that it has become nearly impossible for most people to travel in and out of Ireland because of the restrictions, and I'm not saying that they shouldn't have been there, but how in God's name did the American troops, who were going off creating destruction and destroying communities and lives in various parts of the world and using Shannon to do so, how were they immune from the restrictions? How were they allowed to just keep coming and going as normal, as if it was 1915? And that's what happened.
Absolutely. And we're not surprised by that. And I suppose in some ways what's surprising is that people are surprised, but it shows how much they've hidden the US military in full public view. I mean, I had, when I rang my mother last week, it was the first thing she said to me, oh my God, it's on the news about Shannon and all this kind of thing. And she wouldn't normally be interested, but it was because of COVID putting it on the spotlight. But I mean, isn't that a shame? Like, because it's been obvious, and yeah, we said it like that over the whole period of COVID, the US military continued to travel. There was evidence there about how they went to Japanese islands where there was no COVID at all. They were the only visitors into them. They brought COVID into these Japanese places, infecting elderly populations, undoubtedly causing the deaths of people. And nobody batted an eyelid about that.
We had US troops landing in Shannon in the early days of COVID last year, when Trump was almost denying his existence and was saying, you're exaggerating, it'll be grand. Mm. So the Americans weren't even dealing with it in a serious manner in the early months. Mm. And the American troops were coming in, grand, not a bother. And the Irish Department of Foreign Affairs, no concern, whatever. Mm. They would let anything, they'd do anything, only stand up to the Americans. Mm. And anyone, for anyone who's interested, an opportunity for us to plug our book. But we've written a book between the two of us called The Coalition of the Unwilling. It's built around the Shannon issue. As everyone knows, a lot of people know anyway, we broke into Shannon to highlight the US military use of Shannon. We got arrested. We ended up 3 days in court. We spent a couple of hours in prison. But anyway, we wrote a book about it, and we linked it to the whole concept of neutrality in Ireland. We've linked it to the militarisation of Europe. But it's actually a real interesting read. But for people that want to understand it better, you could do worse than have a look at the book and read it. But Claire, the point you made about the fact that a whole lot of people now are shocked that this is even happening. Mm-hmm. Now, when we broke into the airport, had the trial, and were arrested and brought to prison for a while, they gave us very good coverage, and it did highlight the issue for a lot of people, but clearly not enough. Mm. And it goes on a daily basis, and we've had the likes, all the parties, when Fine Gael were, Enda Kenny in 2003 said that the planes should be searched, but then never, Fine Gael changed their attitude when they went to government. Labour said the planes should be searched, went into government, no, we have to trust the Americans. The Greens said the planes should be trusted, went into government twice now, and not a bother on them. They don't care how many US troops use Shannon. The Greens, God help us anyway. But it's a pity the media wouldn't highlight this issue a bit more.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think the reason why they covered it now, it was like it was a new COVID angle leader. So they wouldn't normally care about the amount of people dying because of the US troops going to theatres of war in the Middle East or whatever. That didn't matter. But jeopardising the health of people in Shannon did matter, and of course we think that matters as well, but it does put the spotlight on the servility of the Irish state. And you're right about the book that we've produced, because what it does is we were able to, during the course of that court case, put the US military on trial. So we were brought to court for trespass, for criminal entry, breaking the bylaws into Shannon Airport. But we brought forward a whole number of really impressive witnesses, including Ed Horgan, who was the one who broke the story of the US troops breaking the COVID guidelines. We put the US military on trial, and we proved the breaches that were taking place of our neutrality. But we also rooted it in, where did our neutrality come from, and why is the Irish establishment so servile? And it is linked to the weak nature of our economy. They think that they're not able to say anything about America because we lose all of these foreign direct investment jobs. So they're prepared to sell the country out, to the tune of even challenging the Apple judgment, going and appealing with Apple. No, we don't want your $13 billion in taxes. No, please come here. Don't pay any taxes. Just give us a few jobs, please, sir, and then you can do what you like. And the reason why they've been caught out is they don't look for documents, because it is one rule for the US military and one rule for everybody else.
Yeah, and we've been left in that vulnerable position by a failed employment policy, and we've allowed ourselves to be dependent on a lot of jobs from foreign direct investment, mostly of an American nature, when in actual fact if this was a well-run country, if Ireland was a well-run country, we would invest in indigenous industry, we'd invest in our own people, we'd help our own people a lot better than we do to set up their own business. It's not like we don't have the calibre. We have a brilliant level of educated people coming out ready for work and inventive. But it is so difficult for these young people to start a business in Ireland because we have been content to remain totally dependent on US foreign direct investment to provide these jobs. And they have us by the short and curlies.
Yeah, and I mean, you're right, like we've been famous for the quality of our education, although I'm not sure how good it is at the moment with our new minister from Kerry at the helm. She wasn't in the Dáil when we were there, but God help her and God help the department, but they have upped the stress levels of the teachers, of the students, of families all over the country. And we're led to believe that they finally sorted out the leave insert that people can choose between doing an exam or doing the continuous assessment. But it's a bit late in the day now and I don't think anybody's really happy with the arrangements. And of course, the schools are still shut. We're led to believe they'll be reopening maybe in March, but some mess there. So I'm not sure how our education system will survive that. But you're told on a business point of view, we have people, you know, on their knees. And this idea that the US multinationals are the only ones bringing work into the country is just an utter nonsense.
No, look, I mean, there's just so many things at play. And just to finish, I mean, we've promised to do a short one today. So, but on the issue of the COVID restrictions at home, and listen, and we've had to have restrictions to get on top of it, but I still harp on the issue that the restrictions have been selective. We kept the factories open, we've kept big industry open, we've kept the mines open, we've kept meat processors open. Most of the big stuff has carried on as normal. It's the economy, stupid. So we have put, in many ways, we have put the economy before public health. So our lockdown has been selective. It has taken away the quality of our life. It has taken away the potential for making a living for small industry, family restaurants, family pubs. Small shops are the ones who have suffered the most. The public in general are suffering the most, I'd say mentally anyway. It's been so difficult. But maybe we could have got on top of all this quicker if we had done, if we had treated the big business in the same way as we treated the small business. I still don't understand how you can go to work in a workplace where there's 300 or 400 others and you work there all day and in the evening you can't even go for a drink with your friend or even go see him in his apartment or house.
Well, you made the point before and I mean, it's 100% right. Like that, actually, for most people, what would zero, you know, lockdown zero mean for most people? Most people are locked down already. It wouldn't make any difference. It's only the big business and so on who would be impacted. Most people are stuck at home with their kids, working from home or not working. And yeah, it's very, very tough, you know. But I think one of the other issues we were going to touch off, because it's kind of linked to Shannon, but we did finally manage after 6 months of trying, both in terms of Ireland at home and the European institutions, to get our hands on Ireland's PESCO implementation plan. Now, PESCO, which most people will know, is the European Union Permanent Structured Cooperation in terms of defence. Ireland is part of it. Most EU member states are. We didn't have to join it. We joined it, which for us being a neutral country is ridiculous. There's a whole chapter in the book about that. We won't tell you the full lessons of it, other than to say that the report has been published and we see the Irish taxpayer funding exercises like buying new NATO-compatible artillery battery, big guns, in other words, that get pulled along behind tanks. What we need them for, I'm not sure. Our continued training of the and assisting in the training of the Jordanian army as part of a NATO exercise. How in God's name we are funding that, I don't know either. But we'll come back and talk about that again, because this is money that otherwise could have been going on public services or whatever. It's an abomination that we are linked to these projects, which is part of the bigger military-industrial complex here at the European Union, which we will be tackling in committee next week anyway.
Yes, and it would be nice if the media at home would actually challenge the ministers in the peasant government and ask them, do you think it's a good idea to be buying arms that are compatible with NATO's ambitions, or do you think we should spend the money actually solving the housing crisis? Answers on a postcard, please.
Well, yeah, and I mean, there is a strategic discussion underway in Ireland at the moment about the future of our defence policy, which is the first time in about 30 years. They've had a big white paper on defence. A lot of it hasn't been implemented, but that's open for contributions. And in fairness, it is an opportunity to examine these things. I mean, Ed Horgan, who we quoted earlier, our friend from Shannon Watch, is putting in a very important submission to that, where Ed has repeatedly, and he's a former army officer, questioned the validity of Ireland having a traditional army in the first place. That as a small nation, if a bigger country invades us, but there's going to be absolutely nothing our army can do about it. And no small country is going to want to invade us. So why do we need this type of army? Really, an army should be there to serve its people for coastal protection, mind our coastal waters, help in air, sea rescue or whatever, and international peacekeeping missions. That's what we should be doing. We, yeah, like other countries, if we were invaded, the only hope we'd have would be a guerrilla war, not a conventional one. So why do we need this? And I think it's a discussion that we should come back to and provoke people into thinking. The army in Ireland has a really high standing. People like it. I'm from a 3-generation army family myself. I like our army, but we could be doing so much better. I think we could be a beacon globally.
Yeah, and the fact that the right-wing parties, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, are so comfortable with the increasing militarisation of Europe, and they're actually keen to be part of it. It's the scary part. Mm. We do need a discussion, and a discussion not just in the Dáil. We need a discussion among the citizens of Ireland, and give them, educate them, let them know what's happening. Let them know what the choices can be, and give the people a say. It's actually called democracy, even though we don't see an awful lot of it, except once every 5 years when you get a chance to vote for someone. But there should be an honest, open discussion about this, and give the people a chance to have their say.
Mm. And the men and women in the defence forces who are really poorly treated, and that when all the money is going on hardware. So absolutely a discussion that needs to be had, but for another day.
Well, there you go. You can't say that wasn't thought-provoking. If you have any opinions, please email us on therosslairpodcast@gmail.com. I'd like to ensure our listeners that we have not edited or doctored in any way the excerpt from this podcast. I'd also like to take this opportunity to thank Claire Daly and Mick Wallace for allowing us use the material. Keep on listening to TRP.